The time is 4:08. We're running 8 minutes behind schedule, and the next program comes to you live.
This is Viv Sutherland. We have a very special program for you this afternoon, part of our ongoing series on the myths and realities of cancer. This is Women and Cancer. According to the Federal Social Indicators for 1973, cancer is the leading cause of death among females aged 25 to 64. That's a pretty large group of the population. And we have with us today as our special guests Dr. Philip Strax, who is the director of the Guttman Breast Diagnostic Institute, Richard Klarberg, who is director of the Public Health Center of the American Health Foundation, Mary Overton, assistant executive director of Cancer Care, Denise Dillon Fuge, a member of the Committee on Women in Health, the National Organization for Women, New York chapter, and also a medical editor at Memorial Sloan Kettering Institute, and Pam Booth, who is a representative from the Women's Health Forum, which is also known as HealthRight. I'd like to start our program by asking each of our guests to talk a little bit about their particular group and what it does, and hopefully provide our listeners with some information they can use. Dr. Strax?
Yes, thank you for this chance to say that breast cancer is not a common disease. Of every 15 women, only one will ever get the disease in her lifetime. However, it is a serious problem for women because it is the most common cause of death in those aged 40 to 45, and some people say 35 to 50. And the difficult part of the whole situation is that we've had a stationary death rate for the last 40 years from breast cancer. Just as many women proportionately die from breast cancer as did 40 years ago, in spite of all our various types of treatment. And we have certain things in mind when we talk about this, and that is that perhaps we are relying too much on women to find their own cancers, because 95% of cancer is found by women themselves. We also know, however, that if you find a cancer when it's localized to the breast, 85% of the women are alive and well 5 years later. Our present forms of treatment are successful when we find a cancer in the breast and it has not spread beyond the breast. Therefore, when we take these two things together, we come up with the idea that perhaps what we need to do is to get women and examine them before they find their lumps and try to find the cancers in the early stages. And perhaps that way we can make a dent in this stationary death rate or turn it downwards. This was back of the project that we did with the health insurance plan 1963, and at that time we used a large number of women, 62,000, which were in two matched groups. And we did find, after we had done this examination, which included a clinical examination of inspection and palpation, plus the newfangled thing at that time called mammography or x-ray of the breast, that if we gave this examination to a group of women and compared them with the control group, and as we did in this study, we gave it to them four times and follow the what happened to them in both groups, we found a very interesting thing. We saved the lives of one-third of the women in the control group, in the study group, as compared to the control. We say we reduced the mortality by one-third as a result of the examination that we did. This meant to us that here we had a way of controlling breast cancer by doing something to women at a time when they were not complaining. At least, they were not going to physicians. We were bringing them in for the examination. As a result of these findings, we started the Guttman Institute, 1968, to develop better ways of doing the job, doing it on more larger numbers of women, and doing it on women who did not belong to the health insurance plan, hopefully to start a way of doing widespread mass screening and examine women at a time when we could use our present forms of treatment in an effective way. And this has been accomplished at the Guttman Institute, we think. We now do an examination that's much faster, more economical, more satisfactory, more accurate than we ever did before, and has resulted in the establishment of 26 other programs similar to the Guttman Institute in this country, supported by the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society. We're satisfied with the job we're doing, but one of the problems that we have, of course, is that success has brought us other problems. Many, many women want to be examined. It has taxed our facilities to the utmost, and we're trying to expand our facilities to give every woman who wants an examination the proper kind of examination. We've also, interestingly enough, been interested in the low-income women, and we find that they are usually left out in the cold. They do not respond to calls for preventive medical care, and to get to them, you have to go out to their neighborhoods where they live. We have a special outreach program where indeed we examine some 20,000 women every year with special mobile equipment so we can get at the poorer women too.
That sounds very impressive. Did you mention that the examinations at the Guttman Clinic are free?
Yes, they have been free up to now. As to whether we'll be able to continue this in a completely free manner, we're not quite certain at the moment, but at the moment they are, and they have always been free. I might add, too, that the success of the Guttman Institute must in a large measure be ascribed to the cooperation of the American Cancer Society, particularly the New York City Division. Without them, we would never have achieved the success we have. They've been very helpful in every step of the operation from the very beginning.
Mr. Klarberg, if you would say just a few words about the American Health Foundation.
Well, I think the American Health Foundation would certainly second Dr. Strax's remarks. In effect, not only breast cancer, but most cancers, most heart disease, and most stroke are not an inevitable consequence of life. And the American Health Foundation, as a voluntary nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing interest and action in preventive medicine, is working toward raising the level of health awareness among the general public. We do not believe that breast cancer and other cancers must be expected by every woman.
Mm-hmm.
We feel that through research, through clinical programs, and through public health action, we can materially reduce the incidence of these diseases. Underlying the foundation's objectives is the fact that disease prevention is as scientifically sound as our knowledge of disease treatment. And since the medical profession presently readily admits that it has little hope for solving the major problems of degenerative disease by curative medicine alone, the upgrading of disease prevention is a necessary, if not urgent, national priority. So the foundation has a tripartite approach to disease prevention. We have research programs, we have clinical programs, including multiphasic screening examinations, smoke cessation clinics, hypertension clinics, and we have this public health action area, which includes working with insurance companies, with legislators in the area of national health insurance, with children to try to, at an early age, awaken their realization that they have a responsibility for their own well-being, and with women to advise them as to the availability of a course of action in the area of prevention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, that covers, I guess, two aspects of our problem. The third is for the woman who either has cancer, advanced cancer, or who has someone in her family who is stricken with this. And I guess Ms. Overton can talk to that.
Yes, I have to speak to the point of the cancer patient who has the cancer, and in our experience, the cancer is now advanced. This is medically determined, Viv. It's determined between the patient's doctor and our medical consultant. Now, the patient as well is naturally very much affected by this situation, but so, of course, is the family. We're in the picture if the patient can be cared for at home, which is a large part of the cancer population at that stage of the game. And our job is his wellness or her wellness in the face of the illness, if you understand what I mean. And, of course, the focus on the entire family rather than on the disease, because at that stage the whole situation is involved, is important, because the at that time, unfortunately, research may come too late. It might not, but the chances are, and certainly in our 28 years of experience, that has been the reality, speaking of this program theme, that we are dealing with. It is too late, it might be too late, and therefore we deal with the life that they have left and the life that they leave behind them in the members of their family and anyone that's close to them. Incidentally, in New York, we're dealing with many women who are living alone. So it isn't, that's another complication, quite obviously.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned before, you're talking about the incidence between the ages of 25 and 64, but let's remember also that cancer happens to be a disease of old age. And in that situation, you have many more women. And we find in our caseload that 80% of the advanced cancer patients in the over 65 age group, they're 80% of them are women.
Yeah.
20% are men. In that age group. I could say a lot more, but why don't we...
Well, I'd like to just, for you, if you would just touch upon the areas that you that cancer care is active in, counseling.
Yes, and, we're a social service agency, principally. Mm-hmm. And because at that stage of the game, although the medical factor exists, the primary factors are psychological, emotional, certainly economical. The money's gone, if we really bring it down to the basics, and familial, and also, I might say, spiritual. So that our big focus is in the other four areas, in addition to the medical area. Our primary professional discipline is the discipline of social work, and we have professionally trained social workers on our staff that deal with the patient and the family. Usually it's a family member that calls us for help. Usually it's a wife or a husband. Of course, we deal with a lot of women because they're the center of the family, and if it's the wife of a family, it could be her child who's ill, but more apt, it's going to be one of her parents. And yet she's the central figure that may be the one that deals with the situation primarily and calls us. And, of course, the care is in the home. That means that there may have to be some additional help in the home to keep the patient comfortable and to keep the family functioning, which is our job. We have found that where there's advanced cancer, the family tends to wall off the patient for all kinds of reasons, mostly emotional and psychological. But the community tends to wall off the family. So what we're trying to do is to relieve all of that pressure.
And provide some support. You provide financial support as well as...
Yes, we do. In partnership with the family, we have carved out an area of advanced cancer, and we've carved out that part of the population, that large part of the population, for whom there's no other help from any government or other principal service. And we can call that middle income, but that's a mighty wide phrase.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people are getting along without any other financial help, and they're living on an income of $2,000 to $3,000 a year, especially your older person.
Pam, what's the Women's Health Forum up to these days?
Well, the Women's Health Forum is primarily concerned with patient education. And in doing that, we distribute a number of pamphlets on various aspects of women's health care. One of them especially is the gynecological checkup. These pamphlets are really popular, selling over 50,000 a year. And essentially what it does is provide women with basic information about what they can get from their doctors. Now, one of the things that this is telling us is that women are very eager to understand what it is that their health care is all about, that they want to become involved in their health care. They do not want to be passive recipients of health care, but want to understand what it is, that how their bodies function, what the normal variations of their bodies are, and to be able to have that discussion both with health care workers, with doctors, with friends, with peers, and so forth. This area of information, patient education, and preventive care seems to me, and especially from the discussion today, to become a growing interest. And that it seems to me that in terms of self-examination, that women can, for instance, and should examine themselves carefully, especially after the age of 30, that they should go in for their yearly pap smears, and that they can keep on top of their care regularly, that they don't have to wait until something serious looks like it's happening before they see a doctor or go to a clinic. Also, we run health education courses, which essentially shows or gives information and through discussion and through tapes and so forth of the total health care that women can receive and need education that they need to know, so that they see themselves and we see ourselves in terms of our whole body and our whole health care, not fragmented like so often the services are between internists and gynecologists and specialized clinics, birth control clinics, family care clinics. So what we're really trying to do is to make it more comprehensive so that people's health care doesn't fall between the cracks between clinics, so to speak.
Yeah. And our last panelist is Denise Dillon Fuge, who is with Now New York, with the Committee on Women and Health. What's new?
Yeah, I'm with Viv on this committee now, and I agree thoroughly with Pam Booth. I have been getting involved in talking with women about health care and doing a certain amount of teaching recently, and Viv will remember that back in last October at the Now chapter headquarters, we had a meeting at which I had two friends of mine, one of whom is my personal physician from Memorial Sloan Kettering, one of whom is an expert in mammography, Dr. Snyder, and then a cancer surgeon called Dr. Virginia Pierce. And these two women talked to a jam-packed room of women, and it was one of a very exciting meeting at our institution. And developing from that, I was thinking about it later, and I have been asked to speak at various meetings as a result of that. And I have become very, very well aware, as Pam has, that women want to get involved in their control of their own bodies and in understanding what is happening when they go to a doctor. And with the recent surgence of women's rights and everything else, it's becoming very, very clear that women are beginning to talk now, and they're beginning to talk out. And the sort of women that doctors always viewed as the very good patient, the woman who came in and sat for 2 or 3 hours waiting to be seen, then he would go in and examine her and say, well, take this, do this, and she would be out the door, and he would write up the chart, and that was that till the next visit. Those days are gradually becoming over, because women are now finding that they want to take time with their physician. They want to say, now, what is this test you're doing? Why are you doing it? And one of the things that came out when Dr. Pierce was speaking to the Now membership, she took out a blackboard and in very simple terms and simple language explained what a pelvic examination was, where the ovaries were. She said, for example, women come to me and they say, I have a pain in my ovaries, and they point to their groin, whereas in actual fact, the ovaries are not there at all. She explained very exactly where they were and why a doctor should always do a rectal exam when you have a pelvic examination, because this is the only way you can palpate the ovaries, which are about the size of the almond in the normal condition. So these women, it was really a mind-blowing experience for these women. It was for me too, in the sense that I realized, as my other function as a medical editor, which is my job, I edit a medical journal at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, which is aimed at physicians and teaching physicians what is happening at Memorial, which is one of the big cancer institutions in this country, how Memorial treats cancer in all its aspects. It's an educational way of talking to ordinary physicians and explaining what is happening at our center. Now, I'm doing this all day long, and then I will go to a NOW meeting as a feminist in the evening and suddenly realize it's incredible. I'm living a double life, and this is crazy. And I am very glad now women are speaking out. And Viv, I've talked with Viv many times on the phone about this, and we feel very strongly that we are now, this committee has been established, which I have immediately joined since I heard of it, a committee on women and health at NOW in the New York chapter, and we're absolutely determined to get a great many things changed in the relationship between physicians and women, so that women do not come as they do, come to my office in tears because they have been to a physician who has not treated them very nicely and say, do you know a good woman physician I can go to who will understand what I'm trying to find out? Now, I can talk a great deal more on this later, but I feel very strongly that all the women's groups, whatever their particular skills are, whether it's self-examination or whatever, we have to, at some point, cooperate together and form a united front in terms of saying to the medical profession, we are 53.5% of the population. We are directed usually to gynecologists and obstetrics, which is a small group in the total specialization, in the total number of physicians in this country. And from what I hear, only 7% of those gynecologists, obstetricians are women, which means that essentially women have to deal with men physicians. So there's an education process on both sides, which is why I'm very interested to be talking with Dr. Strax today, because I have a quote from Dr. Strax. There's an article and mammography and just how much can be done for women with it and not. And in it he says, which I think is very interesting, and I'd like to throw it straight away at Dr. Strax. He says, quote, he thinks that the commotion about women having mammograms, he believes, is a good thing. He says, it is up to women to demand more breast screening centers. Women have the clout. Women need this kind of examination. Women will be the ones who force everyone else into the act. Now, I totally agree with Dr. Strax on that, and I have heard someone else from the American Cancer Society saying, if women push it, they will get it, but until they do, nothing will happen. And I think this has been the history of women over the years. So I feel we have a certain thought together on this, Dr. Strax. But I would like to hear you talk more on that, too.
I agree with Dr. Strax myself. I don't know where you got that thought from, but I still believe in it.
Good.
And I think that it's really up to women to help themselves. And I would like to do everything I can to help them help themselves. But it is true that women must demand what they need to help themselves, because if they don't, it's going to be very difficult for the males or for other people to help them. We have to help them only when they demand something, when we know what it is that they want. And in the matter of breast cancer, there's something very clear and very evident. Every woman, I think, has a right. She hasn't got a right to get a breast cancer. I wish they wouldn't. But those who do get a breast cancer have a right to have it detected at an early enough stage so they can be cured. This, I think, is a public health right that every woman has. And if it were possible to do this on a large scale by having women examined at a time when they're not complaining, when they don't have lumps, so we can find these early cancers, that's the ideal arrangement, and we must continue to work towards that goal. Every woman has a right to have an examination and find a cancer in its early curable stage.
All right, now that's the problem, of course, and I see it as broken down into two parts. The first part is, where are we going to get the money? Who can we get to give us the money to set this up, so that Gutman, as you say, is just overwhelmed with phone calls and with letters. The other problem, I think, is also central to the issue, and I'm afraid that it may not be given enough weight. I know an awful lot of women who will put off going to a gynecologist, who will put off having their breasts examined, who will not do their own self-examinations because it's embarrassing. You can talk what are you crazy? What do you mean you won't do it yourself? It's, you know, how can you're embarrassing yourself to death. That carries no weight. There has to be something that we can do to get women to start thinking of themselves as people with value, as worthy of having their bodies carefully looked after and watched over to make sure that these things are detected early, and we have to start coping with the problem of companies that put out vaginal deodorant sprays because you smell bad, and you wouldn't want to touch yourself down there anyway. You're going to spray to cover it up, and it's all bad and icky and horrible. I see that as the central problem we're dealing with, and I think until we can get women to value themselves and to stop Madison Avenue from forcing them into believing that their bodies are dirty and disgusting and something to be ashamed of, it's a long fight, and I don't see any end to it. And I'm just wondering if anyone here has any suggestions.
Well, I think that the question of women taking a greater interest in themselves applies equally to men, and I don't believe that it's merely a matter of embarrassment. If it were, I think Madison Avenue, for the proper fee, could be enlisted in this campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But at the foundation, we are looking into the question of whether or not there isn't a greater problem,
mm-hmm.
whether or not there does not reside within each of us, to a greater or lesser extent, an instinct, an illusion of immortality, something that prohibits us from taking better care of ourselves, from assuming a responsibility for our well-being, whether it's in the area of self-examination or smoke cessation or eating properly or exercising or wearing a seatbelt. What is it that prevents us from assuming this responsibility for our well-being? In the fall, the American Health Foundation will sponsor a conference mm-hmm. on the illusion of immortality.
Mm-hmm.
And we will try to understand this problem from the point of view of psychiatry. Dr. Fromm is invited, a heart surgeon. Dr. DeBakey is invited. Edgar Mitchell, the former astronaut, is mm-hmm. participating. And across the board, a large number of different areas of expertise, each of these people will try to add to our understanding of this instinct, if it is an instinct. But there is, I think that really is the basic problem. Because men aren't embarrassed about their cholesterol levels, yet they do nothing about it. And I don't think anyone is embarrassed about smoking, and most people do realize that it's a deadly sin, and they do nothing about it.
I would like to get on to something about this. You are talking essentially from a male point of view. Now, women is an entirely different problem. Women were chattels. Their bodies were the possession of their husbands. And I mean, you can say, oh, well, this is a feminist point of view, but this is absolutely very, very true in all the women I've ever talked to. They have a self-deprecating view of themselves. Erica de Jong has written a book, Fear of Flying. And in it, and most women who are reading it, whether it's badly written or good, is beside the point. But there are many points in there that women pick up and chuckle to themselves. Now, I showed that book to my husband, and he just couldn't see it, which I realized there's a total lack of communication on certain issues between men and women. And this is one of them. She pointed out that all women, essentially, no matter how attractive or elegant or whatever in the male terms they are, they all feel something is wrong with them. It may be their hips are too big, they're too small, they go sideways or whatever. And this was one of the things that I thought was very, very sad, because it's essentially true of all women. They have been brought up to feel that they are imperfect. They will never be perfect. A man will say, like you have said, I may be worrying about my cholesterol, but I will not be doing anything about it. There's a certain aggressiveness in that. Women have been taught to be extremely passive by themselves. They're seen by men, particularly physicians, and this is where we're getting into it, where they are seen as children. They're talked to as children. In the medical journals at the moment, there's an advertisement. It's for some drug or other. And I have put it up on my wall just to keep me humble. And it is a physician on the phone, a classic physician with his stethoscope round his neck. And he's on the phone, and he's obviously talking to the husband of a woman who's in a state of acute anxiety. And he's talking to the husband, saying what he's going to do for her. And in the way he talks about this woman, she could be a child. She is not a person who is equal to these two men at all. She's ignored. You have the impression that she has not even been talked to about what's been done. And this is basically what women are concerned with. And as this program is a program about women and cancer, I think you can take breast cancer as an example, or GYN cancer, as classic examples of women's fear of looking at themselves. When it comes to breast cancer, the bosom has been an enormous cultural factor in American life. And women are desperately afraid of losing their breasts. They have a fear of touching their breasts, many women. There has been a thing about masturbation in women and women touching their own bodies, that it's verboten. So women do not like to touch their breasts. And this is one of the problems, I think, that has come up when the American Cancer Society really started going into campaigning for women to examine self-examination of the breast. Many